It's 3 minutes after 4 o'clock. Just a reminder, this evening at 5 o'clock, you can hear All Things Considered on WHYY-FM. Tonight, a report on this afternoon's remarks by President Reagan and Soviet leader Gorbachev on the collapsed Iceland talks. Also, the controversy surrounding California Supreme Court Chief Justice Rose Byrd, and a novel peace prize, and a Nobel Peace Prize for Elie Wiesel. We'll hear his reaction to the award. All this and more on tonight's All Things Considered, and tonight and for the rest of this week, you can hear Terry Gross co-hosting All Things Considered. Terry will return on Monday. Also, a reminder that this evening at 7, 91 FM will broadcast live coverage of the debate sponsored by the League of Women Voters between Democratic senatorial candidate Bob Edgar and Republican incumbent Arlen Specter. And right now, it's a pleasure to welcome back Roger Ebert to Fresh Air. Roger Ebert is the nationally syndicated film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times. In 1975, he became the only film critic to have won a Pulitzer Prize for distinguished criticism. Each week, he teams up with fellow Chicago film critic Gene Siskel to co-host the television review program Siskel and Ebert and the Movies, which is broadcast in Philadelphia Sunday mornings at 11 on Channel 10. Siskel and Ebert began working together in 1976 to host sneak previews produced at the Chicago Public Television Station, WTTW. While on, it became the most popular series offered by PBS. Siskel and Ebert moved to commercial television in 1982 and changed the name of their show to At the Movies, while WTTW hired new hosts and continued to produce sneak previews. The newest program, Siskel and Ebert and At the Movies, is produced by the Disney Company. Roger Ebert has just updated his collection of reviews, now available on cassette. The 1987 edition of Roger Ebert's Movie Home Companion reviews over 600 films, including foreign, independent, and documentary movies. Roger Ebert's Prairie Home Companion is... I'm sorry, I knew I was going to do that. No, I knew I was going to slip on that.
That's a great show, too.
Well, just for correction, Movie Home Companion is published by Andrews, McNeil, and Parker. And later on in this hour, we'll open up the phones for your questions about movies.
Somebody asked me if I got the title of this book from Prairie Home Companion, and I said that I thought that probably we had both gotten our titles from the magazine Ladies Home Companion, which came out until about 20 years ago. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, you've been predicting in Movie Home Companion that widespread VCR ownership is going to have some impact on Hollywood and how movies are made.
Yeah.
What's been the extent of that impact?
Here's what's going to happen, and it's kind of a story of statistics, but sometimes statistics can give us good movies since Hollywood pays attention to them. What happened since television came in is that adults stopped going to the movies in significant numbers, except for those few movies every year that are known as crossover or breakthrough movies, the movies that everybody goes to. So that for your average run-of-the-mill movie, the average audience is under 25, and people over 25 are out of the movie-going habit. It's just a fact. What's happened with VCRs, and there are about 36 million of them in American homes now, is that they're owned and operated by people who are over the age of 25. And so they represent a significant secondary market for Hollywood after the movie is played in theaters and goes into cassette and is sold or is rented. And this year, for the first time, Hollywood could figure that at least half of the money they make on any given movie is going to come from the video market, except for the exception of those few pictures that are really blockbusters at the box office. So... My conclusion from those trends is that Hollywood is realizing increasingly that there is a large adult audience out there for movies, and they will be more willing in the future to make movies that are not simply aimed at the teenage market.
Do you think that...
Hope I'm right.
Do you think that Hollywood has now come around to see that it might have a good thing in massive VCR ownership as opposed to the threat it was feeling a few years ago?
They love it. When VCRs first became affordable, and of course now you can get one for as little as $200, they were concerned that this would be the end of the movie box office. And actually, although the last 2 years are off marginally over the record-setting year of 1984, the people who are really losing out to videotapes are the over-the-air and cable broadcasters. Because let's look at it this way. If you're looking at something on your television set, you are at that time a television viewer. And if it is not network, local, or cable television, then they've lost you, not the box office. So the networks, this has been a continuing story over the last couple of years, have been losing share every year, and the national advertisers are aware of that. networks had at one point a few years ago probably 95% of the television viewing audience at any given moment. And between cable and video, they've lost another 20%. They're down to around 75%. So it's good, I guess, for greater diversity. And in particular, it's good for people who like to program their own television, because now with a VCR, you can not only time shift, which is to say look at whatever was on the air whenever you want to look at it, but you can also actually do your own programming by renting cassettes.
How has VCR ownership changed or altered your own movie consumption?
Not as much as it has the average person who newly has a VCR, because I'm in a very particular and peculiar position of seeing every movie that comes out anyway. And I probably see 7 or 8 movies a week without even trying. So that when I come home, I don't necessarily stop off at the corner to rent another movie so that I can see my 3rd movie of the day. Also, I do not, generally speaking, review movies after seeing them on video cassette, because, of course, when I review them, they're new and they're not on cassette yet. What's happened is that I've been able to go back and catch a few movies that I missed from the past, and also look at movies that I love. Again, a 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 100th time. And so that's fun. But for the mass of people who own VCRs, it means for many of them a chance to see movies they would never otherwise see. Because outside of the big cities, a lot of the movies that we talk about on television or that you see reviewed in the newspaper in Philadelphia never open at all. I didn't realize how bad that was until a couple of years ago. I was speaking at Central Michigan University, which is a big school and a good school, and I was asked to predict who was going to win the Academy Award that year, and it turned out that of the 5 nominees, Raiders of the Lost Ark, this is three, four years ago, Raiders of the Lost Ark was the only movie of the 5 nominees that had even played in that town. Chariots of Fire, pictures like that, hadn't even opened there. So you get outside the big cities, and if it's not a car chase movie or a dead teenager movie or an enormous hit, it won't play at all. So now VCRs are helping those people to catch up and to see these movies.
There is something that's very special, I think, about going to the movies. You're sitting in an auditorium mm-hmm. with a bunch of mm-hmm. people, and you don't have the option to get up and make a sandwich during the movie to put the VCR on pause the way you can at home. I'm just wondering if you or your movie watching friends have developed any sense of ritual while watching a movie on a VCR at home to try to retain the sanctity of that movie watching experience.
I know people who form VCR clubs, and 8 or 10 good friends who will get together on a Friday or Saturday night with a movie because they want to talk about it afterwards. I know people who have popcorn, and they've got to make the popcorn just right. I know a lot of people who put the sound through their stereo speakers. I know a few people, and there are going to be more of these, who have big screen television sets now. I think most people still think of big screen television as that kind of projection set you would see at the corner saloon about 6 years ago during the World Series, and the picture would be so fuzzy you could hardly even see the players. Big screen television has gotten a lot better, and there are now 36-inch screens that are almost as sharp as what used to be a 17 or 21-inch screen, and the even bigger sets are also good too, so that I think eventually people are going to try to duplicate in their home something of what you get when you go to a movie theater. But of course, you put your finger on it. You can always hit the pause button and go to the kitchen and make a sandwich. And even though I've written a book on movies on video, I still feel that going to a movie theater is a different and a better experience than looking at a movie on television. And one of the reasons is the movie in the movie theater runs you. You don't run it. It starts and it goes, and you sit there and it happens to you, and it's not something it's bigger than you. It's not smaller than you. And it's a part of a shared communal experience, and it's more escapist. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but I've never had a television viewing experience that was comparable in intensity to a theatrical movie experience.
Are there movies that just for reasons of the screen size or any other aesthetic or just principled reasons don't work on video for you that had a lot of impact in the movie theater?
Not really, but they don't work as well. And in my book, somebody asked me, did you go back and look at all these movies on video before you compiled the book? And the answer is no. There were 661 movies in this book, and I didn't have the 1,200 hours to do it. But I think that common sense would indicate, and I talk about it in the introduction, that anything that's widescreen, big budget, special effect, outer space, thriller, action, adventure type entertainment is going to lose something on television. Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark, movies like this, Gandhi, with all of its historical spectacle, it's not going to be the same. It's not going to be quite as good. But there's a trade-off. First of all, you can see it for a second time that way if you want to. Or if you can't get out of the house, or if it didn't open in your neighborhood, or if you didn't go when it opened, and it's never going to come back, because second-run theaters are now mostly out of business. Big cities may have a couple of repertory theaters, but basically instead of first run and then second run in the neighborhood, what you have is first run and then pay television and then video store. So the video store is the second run now.
Did you reread any of the reviews that you put in?
Oh, I reread every single review. And
I guess this gets to the hindsight factor. Could define that.
Yeah, well, I mentioned the hindsight factor actually in my introduction because, for example, in my review of Rocky, when the movie came out, I said that Stallone reminded me of a young Marlon Brando. Well, today he does not remind me of a middle-aged Marlon Brando, and so should I go back and take that line out? The answer is no, because the movie hasn't changed. The original Rocky is still the same, so why should I now have a different opinion about it? If you go back and look at Rocky, the first picture, he might remind you of a young Marlon Brando. People forget now, in terms of the cynicism of the later Rocky pictures and their commercial exploitation and the broad strokes with which they're painted, they forget how original and exciting Rocky was, Rocky I. And so, no, I have not. I've taken out, I've edited some of these reviews. I've removed awkward phrases. I've done this. I've done that. I have not changed my opinions, though, not even once.
So your tastes haven't changed over 15 years?
My taste hasn't changed. My taste has probably grown, I hope, and grown more sophisticated. I would hope that I have better taste now than I had 10 years ago. But on the other hand, my opinions really haven't changed. There aren't too many movies. There aren't any movies that I would like now and didn't like then.
My guest is Roger Ebert, and his 1987 edition of the Movie Home Companion has just been published. I don't know if you experienced this since, as you said, you don't consume video the way the normal person does since you're seeing so many movies professionally. Mm-hmm. But I think many people do experience this. I know I do at times. That sense of paralysis when you walk into a video store and you're confronted by, 200 or 1,000 choices of movies to get. And it's not like what's in the movies on the screens. You have a handful of movies that you might want to see that you can choose from, and there's only one or two repertory theaters in town that you can choose from in a given city, if you're lucky at that. Have you experienced that type of paralysis, or do you know others?
Yeah, because I do go into video stores, and I do rent movies. It might be a Saturday night, and it's raining. I have nothing to do, or friends are coming over or something, and rent a movie. What happens is, they often have sales. I mean, there's this price war that's been kind of going on for a long time now, and typical rental prices, it's rare to find a rental more than $2.50, maybe $2, maybe $1.99. I've seen three for $5. I've seen 99-cent specials. Monday night is comedy night, three comedies for $2 and so forth. What people do, even in a rental situation, they have these little shopping bags or baskets like you find in the grocery store. They go around and they think, 99 cents, it's going to be a long weekend. And they rent the movie they came in to rent and six other movies too. And then they try the first half hour of them or they fast forward their window shopping. And that's kind of neat in a way. Now, I'm sure the director is going to have nightmares that somebody's going to take his movie and if they don't like the first 10 minutes, they'll turn it off. But it's neat because people discover movies that way and they take chances on movies.
How effective are previews on the tail of a video cassette movie? You don't see them that often, but whenever I see them, I'm so grateful to have them there.
You mean previews of another movie?
Of another movie that's available on video cassette.
Yeah, well, it's the same sort of thing as trailers and coming attractions in movie theaters. People are fascinated by those. And, this is not the question you asked, but it's interesting. The Hollywood mainstream big theater film industry believes that cassettes are trailers. So that First Blood is a trailer for Rambo. And Rocky III is a trailer for Rocky IV. And Psycho 2 is a trailer for Psycho 3. If they have a best-selling or a best-renting cassette, it sets up people for the next one. And they do find that people go out and then see the movie in the theater. If they've rented the cassette of the first one, they might want to wait to see the second one on cassette. So that the funniest thing that has happened in terms of this whole statistical analysis of the VCR phenomenon is that people who buy a VCR machine go to the theater to see movies more in the year after they buy it than they did in the year before they bought it. Just the opposite of what you'd think. They get involved. They find that they see a movie, they love it. The sequel comes out. They don't want to wait 6 months. I'm not in favor of sequels, but in any event, that is what happens. Or you take Terms of Endearment. This was fascinating. Terms of Endearment opened strongly, even though Hollywood had grave doubts about it. They did exit surveys, you know, marketing experts, you know. Why did you go to see this movie? They thought maybe people would say, I read the book, or I like Jack Nicholson, I like Shirley MacLaine. What an amazing number of people said was, we rented An Officer and a Gentleman, looked at it at home, and then we wanted to see Deborah Winger's next picture. And Officer and a Gentleman, of course, was the number one renting cassette for 3 months before Terms of Endearment came out. So that the cassettes, in a way, they take people out of the theater and then put them back in again.
My guest is film critic Roger Ebert. Can I ask you a bit about your show?
Sure.
You can see Roger Ebert, of course, on Siskel and Ebert and the Movies, which in Philadelphia is shown on Channel 10, Sunday mornings at 11. The show began as a pilot in, I think, 1975 or something at WTW.
Yes.
In Chicago.
A producer at the PBS station in Chicago asked us if we would like to do a show where we reviewed the new movies. And we were both rather reluctant to work with each other because we had been competitors for the two morning newspapers in Chicago, and we weren't really on speaking terms, but we kind of declared a truce and did a pilot, and then there was another pilot, and then there was a monthly show called Opening Soon at a Theater Near You, and then it became a biweekly show called Sneak Previews, and then it became regional on certain PBS networks, and then it became national, and then it became weekly, and by that time it was Sneak Previews. And then 4 years ago, we left PBS and went into commercial syndication with Tribune Entertainment in Chicago, a syndicator. And this fall, after that contract expired, and we signed up for another 5 years with Buena Vista Television.
Can you remember any of the early kinks that you had to iron out of the initial program idea?
At the beginning, Gene and I were uneasy with each other and uneasy with television. And we were, we have... On the show, we have what we call crosstalks. That's what we call the time when we talk to each other. Our original producer thought it would be best if we rehearsed those, or at least had a mental outline of what we were going to say. And we were very bad at that. And there would be take after take. We're talking about 10 years ago, and I would say, wait a minute, that's not what Gene is supposed to say. And we finally, Gene and I got together, and we thought, we can't do this way. We can talk, but we can't rehearse. And so the rule has been very rigid ever since on the show, and that is that when we talk to each other, it is unrehearsed, ad-lib, spontaneous, first take. And it's got to be that way because it's really the only way we can do the show. So that was tough. We found that we were not performers, or at least we were not actors. We could perform, but we couldn't act.
After 10 years of working with each other on the show... is it difficult to maintain the relationship that you have with each other, which I think would be described as, sometimes caustic or mildly caustic or sneering? But it's a good competitive edge.
Well, it's
between
not
the
necessarily
two of you.
Sneering. I think we respect each other and we have respect for each other's opinions. It would be very hard to do that show if there were not somebody across the aisle who was at home. You know what I mean? And I can only imagine trying to do the show with somebody whose intelligence I didn't respect and who I didn't feel was keeping up with me, and I'm sure the other person would feel the same way. There are two other shows on the air with the same format, At the Movies and Sneak Previews, and they've had altogether five people doing those two shows since we left them. Sometimes I find on those shows that the buried agenda seems to be that we have to arrive at an agreement. And you'll hear them saying things like, well, maybe we can agree on this, or, well, would you agree on this? Two critics have no business trying to find out if they can agree or not. They have their opinions, and the point is to express them and to exchange them and to talk about them, and then to remain in disagreement if necessary. And that's easy for Gene and I to do. We don't dislike each other. We don't feud with each other. We do sometimes fight with each other because we get on each other's nerves. And we do compete with each other in print every week in Chicago, so that we have a genuine relationship based upon a shared mission, do the show, and not very much else that we share. We would never be compatible in everyday life. He is, and I have nothing against him, but he's just not the kind of person that I would choose as a friend. And he says the same thing about me. We are different kinds of people. You know, you'll sometimes meet someone and you will say, you know, I know you, you know. We've never met, but I feel like I know you. And the other people that you meet, and you may like them, you may respect them, you may enjoy them, but you realize you wouldn't want to take a two-day Greyhound bus trip with this person. You just are not on the same wavelength. Gene and I are different, and it's been good for the show. I don't have any feeling that I should become his best friend.
I just wonder how that evolves over 10 years, if the edge dissolves at all. Or
what evolves over 10 years is the edge has not dissolved, because. But what does happen is, after you've been in the trenches for a while, you develop some shorthand that's kind of fun. In my book, I have a glossary of movie terms in the back, and it's tongue in cheek. It's not the, you know, like close up and long shot. Maybe one of my favorites is fruit cart. And this is something Gene and I, you know, in terms of watching hundreds of movies over the years, have developed a verbal shorthand. One thing we've noticed is, in an ordinary action picture, like a James Bond picture, whenever there is a chase scene in a foreign locale or an exotic nation, it is 100% certain that during the chase, a fruit cart will be overturned, that melons and oranges and apples will roll into the street, and that the native vendor will jump out into the street and shake his fist at the speeding Maserati that is disappearing in a cloud of dust. And so we'll be watching a James Bond picture, and James Bond and the villain will, you know, start on a road chase, and one or the other will shout out, fruit cart. And then about a minute later, a fruit cart will indeed be overturned, and then we will say, thank you very much. So that's fun. It's fun to, you know, to be on the beat with somebody and to be able to share some of these kinds of, I don't know, in jokes, if you want to call them that, and so forth. We have a lot of fun just being so familiar with certain cliches in movies. And as a result, I think sometimes if you watch our show, maybe we're a little too hard on certain movies for that reason. One of the things that we both are often found saying is, this movie was too predictable. Well, maybe if you hadn't seen and reviewed thousands of movies, it might not have been that predictable. But I am always, and I think movie critics as a group are always very open to movies that are something that take an approach they haven't seen before.
Do you two generally agree on what set of films to review for each week?
Usually there's not even any discussion about that, because we review, it's pretty obvious, we review most any film that comes along that is major and goes into national release. And then we also review a lot of movies that don't go into national release, that only play regionally or only play in the big cities. Art films, for example.
Now, when you review the films together, if you're sitting in a screening room and watching something together, do you try to remain poker-faced so as not to show the other one what you're thinking about the film?
Yeah, I think the rules of the game for movie critics in general are that when you attend a professional screening, you keep quiet and don't discuss the movie on the way out of the theater. Talk about anything else but the movie. It's permitted to laugh, I guess, and, you know, to have other signs of reaction. I have been to critic screenings in New York with some of the most famous New York film critics who do verbally talk, you know, and I've heard unnamed famous critics say things like, give me a break, you know, or, oh, no, not again. And I think that's bad news, because sometimes what one person doesn't see at all as working will be somebody else's favorite film, and you kind of have to give the movie a break.
Do you read each other's reviews in print?
I don't read the Chicago Tribune, and haven't read it in a year and a half because it's on strike, and I don't read scab newspapers. How's that for an answer?
And
when it wasn't on strike, no, I didn't read his reviews in print because I didn't want to know what he thought about a movie until we did the show. I sit there in the balcony, and he gives his review of a movie, and that's the first time I've heard it, which is better for the show. It wouldn't be good if I read his review and figured, well, this is probably what he'll say, and here's going to be my answer, because then it would sound as if I had prepared all my lines.
No.
And there are certain critics doing this format right now who seem to have prepared lines. One of them is, this movie is the worst thing to come out of Canada since Margaret Trudeau. I heard somebody say that on one of our clones, and I thought, that's not film criticism, that's gag writing. Also, it wasn't fair to the movie.
What movie was it?
That was a joke.
And you're the one with the Pulitzer Prize.
Sorry.
Does Gene Siskel abide by that same type of rule of not reading you? Do you know?
He certainly doesn't quote my reviews if he does read them. I'll say that for him.
Where do you think you have the most box office impact?
We have an impact in what you might call a crossover audience. If a popular movie, a big hit, is going to be a big hit despite the critics, and you can tell the specialized audience that they might enjoy it too. For example, Star Wars comes out, and the lines are around the block before it opens. But what critics could say is, hey, if you're interested in a very high-energy movie that's state-of-the-art in special effects, this is a good one. This is not another crummy science fiction film. The other thing we can do, I think, is sell a specialized film to the wider audience. A movie like My Dinner with Andre, which apparently our show did save. The closing notices were posted, and after it caught on, it went on to play in 900 theaters around the country. People had heard about it, and they had read good reviews about it, but still, they were the kinds of reviews that made them think that they didn't necessarily want to see a movie where two guys talk for 2 hours. I think what critics can do in a case like that is say, it was fun. It was stimulating. It made me think. I got involved. It wasn't boring. So that frequently that works. And in cases like that, I think we are very useful because we bring films to people's attention in a way that allows them to be able to see themselves as seeing that film.
Now, are you courted by producers or directors or publicists who feel that your word might have a big impact in the box office for their films?
Courted, no. One good thing about our location is that we're in Chicago. I think it would be, the show would probably, we would have different lives if we lived in Los Angeles. The show comes out of Chicago. There's no industry there. The people aren't around. You don't go into restaurants and see them. They don't meet you on the street or at the gas station. I mean, in Los Angeles, it seems like I'm always getting my rental car filled up with gas right next to Bette Midler or Richard Dreyfuss or somebody. And in Chicago, we're totally out of the movie mainstream. Also, I think that the studios have a totally different approach to criticism. They feel very sincerely that a commercial movie will make it without the critics and a non-commercial movie won't make it even with the critics. Of course, by definition, that always turns out to be true because it's just like, for example, no good movie ever had a bad title. That's a great Hollywood saying, and of course, it's by definition true if you stop to think about it. So, no, we don't get courted, to make it short.
There's a new opening to the show that's now Siskel and Ebert and the movies. Could you describe what that sequence is?
Well, you're talking about the 35 seconds where Gene and I are in our offices and then we walk through the loop and go into a movie theater. When we were doing the opening for At the Movies, it was being syndicated by Tribune, which is a Chicago-based company. And they were very uptight about letting anyone know that the show came out of Chicago because they felt that, you know, in most of the country, people would say, why doesn't it come out of Los Angeles? Or why doesn't it come out of New York? This show can't be any good if it comes from Chicago. This despite the fact that we had obviously been on PBS for 4 years coming out of Chicago. So we did kind of a generic opening where we walk into a theater that could be anywhere. And when the new show came along for the Disney people, Buena Vista Television, we had some conferences on it, and my argument was, what makes us different from the other people doing these shows? What makes us different from the new people on At the Movies or the people on Sneak Previews? We are working journalists. We live in Chicago. We work in Chicago. We work for newspapers. We sit down. We type. We cover a beat, and once a week we do the show. So why don't we emphasize that in the opening? And so that basically gave us the idea of the opening where you see Gene at a computer, me at a typewriter, and then we walk through the loop. And then there's a little gag that I kind of like. And I wrote the open, by the way. Gene's newspaper truck pulls up and it says, read Gene Siskel, and then mine pulls up and it says, trust Roger Ebert. I like that.
That sounds like you wrote that.
Yeah, I did. Well, I said to Gene, look, Gene, you know, the name of the show is Siskel and Ebert, so you go first in the title. But, of course, the punchline can't come before the setup. So if it were only, I said, you know, it could say, read Roger Ebert, trust Gene Siskel, but then the show would have to be Ebert and Siskel. So he thought it over and caved in.
Well, how is that decided whose name goes first? Because it's obviously not alphabetical.
There's a amount of bitterness involved in that on my part. When At the Movies started 4 years ago, the deal was that Gene won the flip. So for 2 years it would be Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, and then for 2 years it would be Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel. But, of course, they only shot the marquee of that theater one way, so that it was Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert the same way for 4 years. I never got my turn. Then Disney came along and said, well, more people say Siskel and Ebert than say Ebert and Siskel. And I said, well, of course they do, because I never got my turn. Otherwise, they'd be brainwashed in the other direction. And I lost.
But you can still say I'm the guy with the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah, that's right. That is a consolation prize, a very nice one.
And a very effective line, I must say.
And I also have a book out. I have 3 books out, and Gene doesn't have any books out. So what can I say? What can I say?
Now, in the opening of the...
is petty anyway, isn't it?
In the opening of Siskel and Ebert and the Movies, as you were describing the sequence with you leaving your newspaper environs, and you're pictured at an old-fashioned manual typewriter while Gene Siskel's is pictured at a word processor, more modern.
Yes, this is rather ironic because, as a matter of fact, I'm computerized. Gene works on every newspaper man works on a computer these days. Gene is still trying to figure out his computer. He's totally intimidated by computers, and I love computers. Like a lot of journalists, my life has been changed by the 4-pound battery-powered portable so-called laptop computer. And I never go anywhere without one, and I write stories wherever I am.
Does that reflect the opening sequence where you're at? Does that reflect a difference that you see between yourselves as journalists?
The fact that I'm at a typewriter?
Well, the more old-fashioned movie journalist type.
There's a more pragmatic reason. They shot that actually in my office. That is really my office at the Sun-Times. It's the size of a clothes closet. And the camera had to shoot in through the door. They couldn't move anything. And so if I were at my computer terminal, which you can see in the background, by the way, I'd have my back to the door. So they said, well, turn around and use the typewriter. Sorry to disappoint
that's
you.
That's the story behind that. My guess,
that's like, you know what that's like, the Satyajit Ray story, the great director from India who was said, well, now in the Apu trilogy, the camera rarely moved, but now in your later films, the camera moves. Why is that? And they said, we got better equipment.
My guest is Roger Ebert, and his latest edition of Roger Ebert's Movie Home Companion has just been published. And in a few moments, we'll open up our phones if you have any comments or questions about movies, either on video or in the theaters. You can give us a call now at 923-2774. That's 923-2774, and we'll be getting to the phones in a few minutes. You and Gene Siskel appeared recently on Howard Stern's show, and we heard that in Philadelphia, now that Howard Stern's on Philadelphia Morning Radio. Did you learn much about his taste in movies when you were on the show?
Nothing. Nothing about his taste in movies. He is an amazing broadcaster, and we have somebody like him in Chicago, a couple of people, Jonathan Brandmeier and Steve Dahl. That will be fascinating to everyone in Philadelphia to learn, I'm sure.
But there are other Howard Sterns.
Yes, this is a new genre of radio broadcasting, and there is one or two of these guys in every big city now who specialize in walking the line of good taste and permissible language on the air. And, of course, they've even found some words to use on the air that we never used to think could be used on the air. And sometimes they go over the line. Sometimes they're in bad taste. Sometimes they're funny when they're in bad taste. Let's face it. Now, Howard Stern is a very smart broadcaster, I think. He's very intelligent and he's very fast. And it was fun to be on his show.
Was there any before the show preparation that you
went
through?
None. In fact, he didn't know that we were going to be the guests. And they do this, they blindfold him and you're the mystery guest. Well, you know, occasionally in this whole business of being on television and doing movie reviews, we have to ask ourselves the question, would Pauline Kael do this? You know, when we were on PBS, we had the dog of the week. We have now dropped the dog, you know. We don't do the dog of the week anymore. And we would say, Gene, do you think Pauline Kael would appear on television with a trained dog? You know, would Pauline Kael be a mystery guest? And I've just got to be frank with you. Pauline Kael is the greatest film critic in America. No, she wouldn't. But I'm not the greatest film critic in America. And what the heck, you know? It was fun, actually, to be the mystery guest, especially when he thought we were Penn and Teller.
How did he get to finding out who you were? How many questions did it take?
I don't remember. Of course, Gene blew it because we were only supposed to give one word replies, like yes or no, and Mr. intelligence didn't hear that instruction, so he was answering, well, not exactly, you know, and of course then you can recognize his voice. Gina's always so intense, you know, all right, we got to go in here now. Okay, we're going to do this now. And he never listens to anything, you know. I get very frustrated with him sometimes. He's always too wound up to listen to instructions.
And that's Roger Ebert, and he's my guest now on Fresh Air, and we'll get to the phones right now. If you'd like to give us a call, our number is 923-2774.
What do you think about Howard Stern?
I actually like Howard Stern. I guess it's the safest way I can put it is he's a guilty pleasure for me. I think he's pretty funny at times, you know, offensive at times too, but he is very quick-witted. I must say that a lot of the people around here will admit to Howard Stern as a guilty pleasure, people in the staff here, and you'll hear lots of people going, you know, you schmuck, how could you say this to me?
So well, now the morning we were on, he was screaming at that woman who wouldn't turn off her radio, you know, because if you have the radio on, there's a seven-second delay. And so if you have the radio on in the background, you won't be able to talk to Howard Stern. It's the same with any radio station because you'll be listening to yourself 7 seconds ago. And she wouldn't turn it off, and he screamed something unprintable at her. And it was very funny because it was probably it expressed the feeling that a lot of people had.
Well, I guess you have to have some degree of appetite for abusive talk on the radio, but he is very clever.
Yeah, sometimes they go over the edge, especially with the business of harassing people at home and waking them up and... you know, that's another specialty.
Of course, Howard Stern is not the only person to do that on morning radio.
You know, one thing that is funny, this guy in Chicago, Brandmeier, has all of his listeners know that if they, you know, they now have telephones on airplanes. You know that. In the first class section, they have a telephone there, and you put in your credit card, and you can make a call. The deal is this. If you're flying on an airplane and you spot a celebrity on the airplane, you call Brandmeier Collect, and if you can deliver the celebrity on the air, you get a prize. See, and so here's somebody, and he's on early in the morning. He's on from 6 to 9. So here's somebody who got up at 5 o'clock in Chicago, went out to O'Hare, you know. They're half dead. They crawl onto the airplane, and then here's some clown, you know, standing in the aisle with a telephone saying, gee, aren't you Howard Cosell? Here, Jonathan Brandmeier wants to talk to you. And these people always sound so angry, you know, because they're just, they can't believe it. And then, of course, the listener gets a prize. So I guess, that once again, I should be slapping. That's terrible, isn't it? I shouldn't. It's a guilty pleasure.
That's terrible,
yeah,
isn't
yeah.
it? Well, let's get to the first phone call at 923-2774. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I was wondering, Roger, is there a tried-and-true criteria that you would use to determine whether a movie is good or bad? I also wanted to ask another question. Do you feel that there's a difference between movies that make it movies being presented on large screen and movies being presented on television screen?
First question. No, I don't have any abstract or objective criteria for whether a movie is good or bad. Movies have a way of surprising you. They'll blindside you. They'll come at you from a direction you weren't anticipating. They will be good for reasons that you didn't think you would enjoy, perhaps, or they'll have everything in them that you should like, and they still don't work. So I just keep an open mind when the lights go down. And I bet you tuned in after we already talked about big versus little screen. My feeling is the best way to see a movie is in a movie theater. Really is. It really is. And I love VCRs and I love cassettes. And I've got a book of 661 movies on cassette reviewed here. And nevertheless, the best way to see a movie is in a movie theater. Just is.
Thanks for calling. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, Roger, thank you for saying what you're going to do about scab newspapers. I think it's great that somebody finally says something like that on the air. Recently, or back before he died, Orson Welles made the statement that there should be more black and white films at that medium. And then just recently, the great woman of the stage has said that people should cross, and of the theater, Marlene Dietrich, said that people should cross themselves when they mention his name. First of all, I'd like you to comment on the films itself, coming back to black and white, and secondly, do you agree with her assessment?
Should they cross themselves? Marlene Dietrich has now forgiven Orson Welles for one of the great Orson Welles stories. She threw a gala ball for him in Paris, and he forgot to come. So I guess she's forgiven him now. Orson Welles is right. Black and white pictures are great. And, of course, right now we have the abomination of so-called colorization, where they are taking black and white movies and they're not really turning them into color movies. That's a misnomer, because color is glorious in its own right, and black and colorized movies do not look like they were shot in color. There's nothing wrong with black and white. A black and white movie is not a movie with something missing. It's a movie with a dimension added, because if you stop to think about it, the real world is in color. And so black and white, by taking the color away, stylizes the statement and stylizes the look of the picture and the visual style of the picture in a way that color doesn't. And I'm appalled by the fact that wonderful movies like The Maltese Falcon and The Third Man and Casablanca and hundreds of others, It's a Wonderful Life, Miracle on 34th Street, are being colorized. I look at it from several points of view. First of all, it's like putting graffiti on a painting, to take somebody's black and white picture and deciding that that should be pink here and blue there and yellow here. That's vandalism. Secondly, it's theft, if you stop to think about it. Not criminal theft, but moral theft, because many of these pictures are out of copyright, and the people who made them, or even if they're not out of copyright, there was no provision in the original contracts for any television, cable, or video sale. The people who made them are not making any money off of them, and the people who are destroying them by colorizing them are making all the money. Frank Capra and Jimmy Stewart don't make any money from It's a Wonderful Life, but the colorizers who have turned it into an embalmed travesty, they do make money. So that's a shame. Colorizing, if you've seen colorizing, and I recently, for example, saw Yankee Doodle Dandy colorized on Ted Turner's WTBS. The faces are all the same complexion. The backgrounds are all the same color. Some of it's colorized. Some of it isn't. There's no feeling of shadow or depth. It's all very flat. It's like a layer of color put on top of something. And it's a mess. It's a mess. It's a crime. I would encourage people when you go to a video store, to insist on the black and white version of a picture that you know was shot in black and white, and to refuse to watch colorized movies on television, because what they're doing is they're stealing a whole aspect of our cinematic heritage. They're stealing it, and they're destroying it.
Thanks very much for calling. Take the next call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I was just wondering about the ramifications of violence, very explicit violence in the movies nowadays. I'm very disturbed by it, and I think it has a very profound impact on younger viewers. And one other comment, I think Pauline Kael's overrated, I think.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, but she's a good critic.
I don't know. She goes on. I mean, I think she gets a bit ridiculous and carried away with.
Well, I'll tell you, I have a funny thing about critics. I don't really care what their opinion is. I'm a critic, and I have my opinion. Even if I weren't a critic, mm-hmm. I still have my opinion. I like the ones whose writing I enjoy and whose insights I enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and you're lucky here in Philadelphia with Joe Baltac and Desmond Ryan, and now Carrie Rickey, who was in Boston and before that was in New York, has just come to Philadelphia.
Yeah.
So you've got some good film critics here.
Oh, yeah. I read quite a few of them. I try to. That's the only way you can find out, is to get different opinions.
As for violence, here's something that you might or might not agree with me on. Violence is one thing when it's shown to have consequences, and another thing when it's not shown to have consequences. If somebody's going to be shot, then let them be dead, and let there be grieving,
Mm-hmm.
And not have the sort of thing like death wish.
The sadistic type of thing. I don't go to see them. Well, I read about them.
Well, I objected to Blue Velvet,
mm-hmm.
Which is
really
one of the most shocking movies of the year. I felt it was well made.
Pauline Kael loved it.
Well, she did, yes, but she didn't say why. She wrote a very peculiar review of Blue Velvet. It was a synopsis.
Yeah.
Read that review, and you won't find anything in there except what is almost like a book report or a movie report, in which she retells the entire movie in a way that allows you to see how she saw it, but she doesn't talk in an abstract way, about what she thought about some of the issues that seemed to be raised by the movie.
What did you think about that? What was your objection?
My objection was, now, I don't believe any subject matter should be off limits to filmmakers or to any artist. I don't object to the fact that there was sadomasochistic sex in the movie. I don't object to the fact, per se, that Isabella Rossellini was depraved in this, was shown in a depraved and brutalizing way and in a humiliating way. I believe, however, that if a director asks an actor or an actress to do that, then the director has a responsibility to go the rest of the way in terms of producing a picture that deserves and redeems and earns that kind of performance. In Cries and Whispers, Ingmar Bergman asked Ingrid Tulin to cut herself in a very painful way, and in the movie it's necessary. In Last Tango in Paris, Marlon Brando and Maria Schneider went as far as actors have ever gone in the movies in terms of revealing themselves, and that was a great movie. But in Blue Velvet, Isabella Rossellini was asked to undergo these experiences, and then the movie itself kept drawing back into an Archie, Jughead, and Veronica joke about Lumberton, USA. Now, I know that, because I'm a clever movie critic, too, and I know how to write these reviews, that he was, you know, you could talk about the dichotomy between the dark side of this small town and the light side of this small town, and the tension between laughter and pain. And that would make a nice, clever review. But the fact of the matter is you have Isabella Rossellini there, undressed and humiliated in public in very extreme scenes, and you do not have the director using her commitment in order to make any statement other than, well, look how funny this all is within the context of my cleverness. So there weren't any consequences that meant anything to me. It was an intellectual exercise in which the director did not have the emotional honesty to follow his actress into the area that he had pushed her. It's hard for me to get that point across because people think I just objected to the violence in the movie. I don't object to the violence in the movie. I object to the fact that the violence wasn't used and followed through on and made a statement about in a way that would have redeemed and made worthy the sacrifices that Isabella Rossellini had to make in order to do it.
I guess as contrasted to how violence was used in, let's say, Taxi Driver. It wasn't sadomasochistic violence, but it was very violent nonetheless.
Yes, it was.
Very much part of the story.
And part of the story, yes.
Well, thank you for calling. Let's take another call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi. My question is going to go back a little bit. I'd like to know, Roger, what it was like to work for and with Russ Meyer on Beyond the Valley of Dolls.
I had a lot of fun doing that. I wrote that screenplay in 1970, and we were like the two lunatics who were allowed to take over the asylum. 20th Century Fox was having a hard period then. I'll never forget, I was on the lot of 20th Century Fox, and the chief publicist, whose name was Jet Four, said, "This studio is going to go bankrupt. Everybody wants to see Easy Rider, and what do we have? Two war pictures and a Western coming out. You know, we're going to lose our shirts." Well, the war pictures were MASH and Patton, and the Western was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, so they didn't lose their shirt. But at the time, the studio had fallen on hard times, and they hired the King of the Nudies to make what was then an X-rated picture, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. I think if it were rated today, it would be PG-13. And not X. And it was fun. Russ Meyer is a very dynamic and original filmmaker, and not a pornographer, incidentally. Some people who haven't seen his pictures think he makes pornography, but he doesn't. I think, actually, the artist that he bears the most resemblance to is probably Al Capp, Little Abner.
Well, I mean, wouldn't you think that the word soft porn is a fair word to describe his films?
Maybe so, in terms of their sexual content, but not in terms of their artistic content. He's widely honored in Europe. He's been honored at the Cinémathèque Française and at the National Film Theatre in London, where he gave the Guardian lecture, and at many film festivals. He's had a retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And there is something in his movies that is the work of an artist and not the work of a pornographer, including the fact that if you look at every one of his movies carefully for the last 26 years, you will only find one scene in 26 years' worth of movies that was edited in order to have an erotic impact on the audience, and that is the lesbian scene in Vixen. Apart from that, he always cuts away from the eroticism and cuts to the visual joke or cuts to the juxtaposition or cuts to the irony. It is almost like his movies are like the world's longest striptease with only the tease and never the strip. It's almost as if he's having fun with his audience instead of catering to what you might assume the so-called dirty old man raincoat brigade wants. He's frustrating that in order to make a comic point.
Well, this might be a really unfair question, but if you felt up to this, or could you summarize the plot of Beyond the Valley of the Dolls?
Yes, an all-girl rock trio is discovered at a small high school dance in Connecticut, and one of the girls in the trio finds out that her long-lost aunt, Susan, in Los Angeles, has a lot of money, and she's been mentioned in the will. So they get in a van, and they go out to Los Angeles, where they are sucked into a world of depraved rock musicianship, and particularly into the under the influence of a man named Ronnie Zeman Barzell, the teenage tycoon of rock, who later on in the movie, of course, turns out to have been a woman all along. They get involved in drugs and alcohol and all kinds of other destructive things, pills, of course, which was from the original Valley of the Dolls. And the plot is really very complicated. I mean, it ends with a quadruple murder and a triple wedding, as you recall, just to get all the strands together. And, you know, I still get letters from people who enjoyed that movie. It got basically bad reviews, although Richard Corliss in Time picked it as one of the 10 best movies of the 70s. I think a lot of people weren't prepared for a comedy, and a lot of people didn't see a comedy, but it was a comedy. It was a satire from beginning to end.
What did you learn about effective low-budget filmmaking in working on that film?
Well, it was made at 20th Century Fox, 2 hours long, widescreen, color, for $900,000. And Russ said that he could have made it for $300,000 if he hadn't made it at Fox. So it was a low-budget picture to begin with, and very profitable. It made $26 million. And yet, even so, the budget was three times higher than it needed to be because of studio overhead. Meyer can make a movie, can deliver a two-hour theatrical feature for around $200,000.
How does he do it?
He does all the jobs himself. He's a true auteur. You know, this is a real auteur. He can write a screenplay. He can cast it. He can direct it. He can use the camera. He can do the sound. He can edit it. Then he can distribute it, and then he can go out and publicize it. And I did an article about him once in Film Comment in which I said he really is a true auteur. He not only shoots his own pictures, but he carries his own camera.
Has his recent career been like?
Well, of course, he's a very rich man because he has 27 films, and they're all in cassette, and he owns 100% of the rights. So you can just put that together and, you know, get out your calculator and figure out that he's not looking for his next meal. He's working on a six-hour personal epic now called The Breast of Russ Meyer. And this will be released on video, and it's his entire life. He has gone back. You know, the most important thing that happened to him was being a Signal Corps cameraman in the infantry in World War II. He waded ashore at Normandy. He took the pictures of Patton that were used in the movie Patton. And he has been the corresponding secretary for his army group ever since. So he went and talked to everyone he served in World War II with, recorded all their memories, went back to Europe, shot in the same places where they had fought the war. Only now he is introduced into these places, such as beachheads and the fields of France. His trademark, women with enormous bosoms. And I said, well, I saw part of the picture, and I said to Russ, are you trying to get people who are interested in big chests and interest them in the war? And he said, just the opposite. I'm taking people who are interested in the war and trying to interest them in big chests. To him, he's one of the few people I know who you can say his life is all of one piece. Everything is there. Everything that he is interested in is all in the same compartment. He doesn't put the war here, business here, his movies here, his sex life there. It's all part of the same thing.
Well, I'm sorry to say that we're out of time, but it's really been fun talking with you. My guest has been Roger Ebert, and his book, Roger Ebert's Movie Home Companion, has just been updated. The 1987 edition has just been published by Andrews McMillan Parker. You can also see Roger Ebert on Siskel and Ebert and the Movies, which is shown on Channel 10 Sunday mornings at 11 o'clock. Well, it's 3 minutes to 5 o'clock, and in 3 minutes, we'll hear tonight's edition of All Things Considered, live from Washington, D.C. Tonight and for the rest of the week, you can hear Terry Gross.